If you're LGBTQ+, or know someone who is, our new project, Queerlay, is for you. I'm lead reporter Caitlin Hernandez. Join me and let's tell our stories of queer joy on the LA Report on las.com/queerla.
I'm John Horn. Each week on Retake from Elias Studios, I talk with the people who make your favorite movies and TV shows and bring you the latest entertainment news. Retake wherever you get your podcasts.
Don't run away from that TV set. Here I am again, Howard Lindsay, general manager of Giant Felix Chevrolet. You know, Giant Felix Chevrolet was founded in 1921. And although there's many changes have taken place, one thing that has not changed is old-fashioned friendliness combined with modern mass merchandising, stocking and selling in thousands to give you, the customer, a fine discount on a new car. And here for our Spanish-speaking friends is my friend, Mr. Chavo Rubalcaba.
En efecto, amables amigos, esta gran agencia fue fundada por...
One of the early television commercials for the landmark Felix Chevrolet in downtown Los Angeles. Felix, one of the many car dealerships that became locally famous, because you'd see the owners of those dealerships or the sales managers on local television this way back in the black and white days. Many of those ads live from the dealerships themselves, sometimes their pets taking part in the ads, but it was part of local Los Angeles color for those of us who grew up here. But even predating television, in the very earliest days of the automobile, Los Angeles played a huge role in the car business. And that's the story that's detailed in the new book, Driving Force, Automobiles and the New American City, 1900 to 1930. Joining me are the co-authors of the book, Daryl Holter and Stephen G. Daryl is a historian, adjunct professor of history at USC, and he managed auto dealerships, including the famous Felix Chevrolet in downtown Los Angeles. And Stephen G. is a writer and television producer. Both of these gentlemen have been with us multiple times on the show. Thank you both for being back with us. I appreciate it very much. Terrific book, and so much to learn about the importance of the early industry. And I'll just throw it out for either of you to respond. How central were these first dealerships in Los Angeles to helping fund the overall American car industry?
Well, they were really important. But I'd first like to say thanks for putting us on, because, you know, if we didn't have public radio, we probably wouldn't be here. So I want everyone who's listening to know that.
Thank you. That means a lot. Appreciate that, Daryl.
This is a startup industry, and no one really knew. Most people didn't think that the horses were going to be replaced. And so the manufacturers themselves were trying to figure out how to make a car, and then they had no idea about how they could merchandise it. And so these dealers who really stepped up and tried to figure out how to do it at the beginning in 1900, they were really creative people. Many of them, it didn't work what they were trying to do, but some of them were very successful at it. And California became a center for cars, and a kind of a city of cars, in part because of the geography and the climate and everything, but also because of the role of these individual people who really stepped up to the plate and played an important role in merchandising cars.
Well, and I think by the 1920s, you have the fastest growing city anywhere. Los Angeles pretty much doubling in size in that decade, and it goes to, what, a million cars on the road by the end of the 20s? I mean, it becomes a phenomenon.
Right, and so the city grew at the same time that the car grew. And unlike cities that already had their cities in place, like New York and Philadelphia and Chicago, et cetera, L.A. came late, but it came at the same time as the car. That's one reason why both the automobile and the city grew at the same time.
And I think of Wilshire Boulevard, for example, you know, a street that's so designed for the automobile, and so many of the different shopping areas that are designed around the car. As you say, it really went hand in hand. But another effect was, in early radio, the car owners, as part of their desire of selling cars, started radio stations. KFI's Earl C. Anthony was a Packard dealer in Los Angeles, starts that radio station. If I'm not mistaken, KNX was started by a car dealer.
Yeah, I mean, Paul G. Hoffman, who sold Studebakers, starts KNX. We've got Don Lee, who started...
Oh, it's a whole network.
Don Lee starts a whole network. He starts what's now an experimental television station in 1931, which is now KCBS. Earl C. Anthony, who you mentioned, starts KFI Radio, later starts KFI TV, which is now KCAL.
KECA, which is now KABC Radio.
But it's not even that. I mean, we've got more, every sort of technology that's coming along from that period. These dealers are making so much money. I mean, Jack Maddox, for example, was a Lincoln dealer, also sold Fords, starts Maddox Airlines in 1927, and starts offering flights down to San Diego. But that was all born out of the money that he made out of the car business.
Let's talk about financing, because one of the points that you make in the book is that the auto manufacturers, when they started, were kind of hand-to-mouth. They didn't really have a sense of financing a car. But it's these Los Angeles dealerships that pioneered that. Daryl, can you elaborate?
This is very, very, very important because, at the beginning, this was a luxury thing. The only wealthy people had, but as the market became broader and more people wanted to take advantage of the freedom that you had with an automobile, there was a great desire to broaden the demographic base for the car. Now, the manufacturers at the beginning didn't have any money. I mean, they couldn't get bank loans because the banks didn't think they were ever going to replace the horse. So they didn't have money to buy any facilities. The dealers had to pay for the facilities. The dealers actually paid dealer deposits in order for the manufacturers to pay for the cars. The dealers provided the working capital for the manufacturers to make the cars. And also, when it came down to financing, this was very important. And what would happen would be, like, a dealer would, a doctor would come in to buy a car and he wouldn't have enough money. The cars had to be paid in advance. There was no payment plan. And what would happen is that the dealer would say, well, I'll sit down with the doctor and I'll take a down payment from him and I'll take a promissory note for 30 days and 60 days and we'll pay it off that way. So the dealers start creatively trying to do the financing themselves with people that they know. And so this is really how it begins. Now, the dealers organize a financing program as early as 1913 in Los Angeles, and it becomes quite effective for allowing people to buy cars on credit. But that's 6 years before the manufacturers do it with GMAC in 1919.
What's so funny, because that's such a profit center for car makers now. They're financial arms, and it's funny that they were kind of late to that game.
And very quickly. Quickly, it takes on, Larry. So by the time you get to 1925, you've got about 70% of the cars in the United States, new and used, that are sold on payment plans. And in Southern California, it's about 85%.
Wow. That is fascinating. You have an ad in the book. Take 10 months to pay for your car. The Automobile Funding Company of America, capital $1 million, can assist you through the dealers who were registered with the company to own a car and pay for it in that length of time. Consult your dealer. He will consult us. Charles A. Bradley, President, Investment Building, Los Angeles. So this is very early
on. Started
by
the dealers.
Yeah, and then you got an early GMAC ad. Another thing that I love about the book are these vintage photographs. I mean, these are incredible. Here's workers installing a Packard billboard at Wilshire and Western in 1926, opposite a Bank of America. There's the Standard Public Market real estate office, and you just get a sense of what the city was like.
Exactly what we wanted to do. We didn't want a book that would sit on a shelf someplace. We wanted a book that people would put on their desk, put on their coffee table, that they want to take out, they want to open up and look. It's got about 160 incredible photos, images in it. It's got a wonderful cover, and it's really made for people to have a good time with. It's really made also for gifts. To give to people, a lot of people that like cars. We're finding a lot of people are buying it to give us gifts.
Well, as always the case with Angel City Press, the art design of the book is spectacular. The publisher is known for that. And I have to say, in full disclosure, they published my book a number of years ago and did a great job on that, too. But it's an absolutely beautiful book. We're talking with the co-authors of it, Daryl Holter and Stephen G. Jay Leno wrote the foreword to the book, Driving Force, Automobiles in the New American City. I'd like to hear from you if you have questions for our guests about how how car-centric Los Angeles developed and how the sales of cars here really spurred car culture along with the design of the city. We're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Stephen, I wanted to ask you about sort of how the car interacted with public transit. We had the red and the yellow line streetcars here in Los Angeles. And how did the automobile essentially supplant that form of mass transit?
Well, there's a lot of sort of mythology about what actually happened. The Pacific Electric Railway Company went out of business, sold the business, I guess, to Western Transit Bus Company in, I think it was 1953. And they basically sold the business because people weren't really using the streetcar system in the way that it had originally been used. The convenience, the cheap nature in which you could buy a car, the affordability of cars just meant that that business disappeared.
The car is so much more convenient because it takes you point to point.
Exactly. And it goes, it could go to places that the rail lines never went in the first place.
Also, it seemed like as traffic got worse, it made it more difficult for the cars to traverse, right? Weren't there logistical challenges there too?
Yeah, absolutely. Spot on.
All right. We're going to continue our conversation with Daryl Holter and Stephen G, co-authors of Driving Force, Automobiles in the New American City. Daryl knows the automotive industry extremely well. Not only is he a historian, but he also was the manager of auto dealerships, including famous Felix Chevrolet with his great neon sign in downtown Los Angeles. Speaking of public transit, next hour we'll be talking with Assembly Member Laura Friedman, who chairs the Assembly Transportation Committee. We're going to talk about the impasse over funding of public transit. As you probably know, LA Metro and BART in the Bay Area are suffering huge deficits, in large part because of the pandemic when ridership cratered, but they're also dealing with the public perception that it's unpleasant to ride public transit now because of so many people that are essentially living on public transit. So we're going to talk about the challenge when we come back. Right now, our focus is on the history of the automobile in Greater Los Angeles. The co-authors of Driving Force, Automobiles in the New American City, 1900 to 1930, Daryl Holter, who in addition to being a historian, he also teaches at SC, has been in the car business for a number of years with his family, owning multiple dealerships. Stephen G., also a terrific writer, joins us. He's been on as well in the past, talk about his many books. Well, let's talk about the importance of advertising from the car dealers. I was mentioning with Mary about how for newspapers, car advertising was huge.
Well, it is huge, but I wanted to just say one other thing that's exciting to be in the studio with you and Mary. It's exciting to hear people responding, because when I watch cable news, I'm not very happy with the content of it. And I think that we need public radio, we need public television, and we need that. So,
Daryl, thank you. I really appreciate that.
It's very important. Advertising was dominated by the newspapers. This starts very early, in the early 1900, as soon as the newspapers, and there are multiple newspapers at that time. And advertising for automobiles becomes extremely important. And that continues all the way up into the internet period. And gradually the shift is so decisive over to internet advertising, because that's really where so many people would go. And, you know, the automobile dealers are you know, they're spending thousands and millions of dollars, but huge amounts of money on advertising. They have to go where it's working for them.
We see a shift, though, I think, in advertising, and correct me if I'm wrong, towards the manufacturers doing the bulk of it. And we see fewer. They're still there, but we see fewer of the local dealerships comparatively advertising. And what's the reason behind that?
Well, advertising, developed over time. You know, when it started, the manufacturers would do advertising mostly in magazines, and the dealers would do the local advertising, and they would do in the classified ads, and they would be the ones who would spend that money. Inside of the industry, there, it was called tier one and tier two. Tier one was what the manufacturers spent on advertising in magazines, largely. The other tier was what the dealer spent at the local level. Then there would be a tier two, which is in between, where dealers put money and the manufacturers match it, and they'll run ads also at the local level that will
highlight the brand and the place
highlight
to buy
the models that they were trying to sell. So it's a complicated thing, but it certainly is an important, and there certainly has been a decisive shift.
Was the service department a part of car dealerships from the beginning?
Well, no. In fact, At the beginning, a person would buy a car, and then they'd bring the car and they say, I've got a problem here. And they'd say, well, we just sell cars. Go down to the corner and there's a guy that can maybe fix it.
Yeah.
Maybe he's a blacksmith. He might know how to fix. But of course, this changes quickly as the market begins to expand. And dealers are very conscious of the fact that when you sell a car to someone, you need to be able to take care of it, the service and repairs of that car. Why? Because the customer will never come back. And you want the customer to come back. My father-in-law, Nick Shamus, who bought Felix Chevrolet in 1955, told me, Daryl, you meet him in the front, you keep him in the back. And what he meant was that you meet him when they buy a car, but then you take care of them in the back. He means in the service department. You take care of their needs. You know, they're your customers, and then they'll come back.
He did TV ads, didn't he?
Oh, he was one of the earliest TV ads.
That's what I thought, yeah.
He had, movie stars. He had Johnny Cash. He had boxing people.
Yeah.
He had Joe Louis. He did them himself. Yeah. He was very, very... He built the sign.
TV dealership owners became local celebrities at that time.
He built the Felix sign.
Oh, wow. Okay. And then Ralph Williams, of course, came along later. So many others. Stephen, let's talk a little bit about a huge news story. 1929 with the auto show fire. I mean, that's massive.
Absolutely enormous. I mean, automobile dealers started the auto show as a way of selling cars. Initially, it was held in a skating rink in 1907, graduates to the hamburger department store. Then they have this great idea. Let's put it in a tent. Tent offers a maximum flexibility. Your show gets bigger, tents get bigger.
Like a big revival meeting, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you have more cars, bigger tents, more space, easy to expand. And that's all going, really well until 1929 show, when the show catches fire, the tent catches fire. It turns out to be an electrical fault. 320 cars were destroyed. It's the largest automobile disaster of its kind in the nation. But what's really remarkable about that situation is that even though all those cars were destroyed, the dealers managed to put the show back on 27 hours later.
Wow. How in the world did they do that?
Well, there's so much money in the car industry by that point. You know, they've really, I mean, it's a defining point, because they've got to a point where, they're so powerful. The automobile has taken over to such a degree that, they just pull their resources together. It's a point of civic pride to come back with an auto show. It shows that the automobile
resiliency.
Exactly.
The trade-in, is that something that started at Los Angeles dealerships? Trading in a car to get a new one?
Well, that's another thing that no one ever thought about. At first, people thought, well, what's a secondhand car? I mean, the first cars were so unpredictable that they would just fall apart and you would
junk them.
You
just junk at the side of the road.
But then as they got better, then they began to have used cars. And used cars, it's really an interesting interesting thing that a lot of people don't understand. But, you know, when customers have a car that they want to buy a new one, they want to trade in the one that they have, they will look in the newspaper or other places to see what the prices are. And then that is in their mind what the value of their car is. But when the automobile dealer or the used car manager looks at that car that they bring in, they look at it and they say, I see it needs tires. It has a scratch here. It needs this. And in their mind, they're thinking the amount of money it would cost to recondition that car to sell it as a retail piece. So there's always there's always a disjuncture that a lot of times people don't understand, and it's there.
Well,
and it's
who's ever gotten what they thought their car was worth when they sold it? Just from a psychological standpoint, I don't know that that ever happens.
But one of the really interesting things that we found was a 17-year-old student who comes from Arkansas and comes to Los Angeles because he wants to study accounting at USC, and he's a poor guy, but he's paying his tuition and he needs to make money. So he starts reconditioning cars. This is 1919. He starts going out and buying cars that are broken down. He fixes them up, paints them. He sells them as used cars. And every time he sells them, he writes down the number of what he's selling for. This was back when you had about 105 brands. So he had all kinds of cars.
Goodness.
So no one knew really what they were worth. But every time he sold one, he would write down the number. Then he takes this list down to the dealers, and he shows them in downtown L.A., and he says, this is what I'll pay for an Ajax. If you have an Ajax, I'll pay you this. And they like it. They're very happy. So they all take his news. This is the beginning of the Kelley Blue Book.
This is where it starts. Was Kelley his name?
Yes, Les Kelley.
Les Kelley.
And he had the largest used car operation on Figueroa Street in the world.
Daryl and Stephen, we could go on, but we're out of time. It's absolutely fascinating. It's a wonderful book. Great to talk with you both. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. The book is Driving Force, Automobiles in the New American City, 1900 to 1930. Daryl Holter and Stephen G. are the authors of the book.
Support for LAist comes from HBO, presenting Succession, the story of a media tycoon and his four grown children in a darkly funny comedy drama directed by Jesse Armstrong. Brian Cox portrays the patriarch of the family, Logan Roy.
Logan is trying to make this Waystar Ryko work, but he knows that it's a mess. Logan is responsible to this thing that he's created. Even though it's become slightly monstrous, he still thinks he can be in control of it. It's that element, which of course is so brilliant in the writing, that sense of implicit honor that Logan requires. He doesn't require devious plannings, which the children are so busy doing time and time again.
Spoiler alert, in a surprising turn, Logan Roy dies early in season 4.
Suddenly, episode 3, he's gone. And when you've removed that one element, you've gone, well, where's the conflict? When you're playing a part that is removed in that way, yeah, it has an effect on you. You feel, hang on, this is one of the greatest pieces of work I've ever been involved in, and suddenly it's no more. But it's also, it reflects what our existence is about, because we're here for a time and then we're gone.
Here's Jeremy Strong, who plays one of the sons, Kendall Roy, and Succession creator, Jesse Armstrong.
When Jesse told me that was gonna happen, I wasn't terribly surprised. I thought it made sense dramaturgically. And then when I read the script, I found it shocking and emotionally devastating.
We didn't really have a death scene for Logan, and that was obviously intentional. We wanted to capture a feeling of death that people experience in the modern era of separation, of communication over phone and email.
Kieran Culkin plays Logan's son, Roman Roy, and Sarah Snook plays daughter, Shiv Roy.
To some extent, this is just, you know, my job, and I'm trying to keep the emotional stakes up and put the character through that and then go home. But the problem with that is going home, yeah, that was Roman going through that, but physically I actually had to go through that. So I was sort of, it's this weird disconnect of like feeling physically like I've gone through some sort of emotional trauma, but I haven't.
I found it was better for me to pull out of it completely so that it could be fresh still. Cause like for me, staying in means that it dulls and it's not good.
Alan Ruck plays Connor Roy.
I was taught a long time ago that you just have to accept the fact that your performance is going to come from all the other characters around you. If you're just open to what is going on. And when Sarah came in to tell me, and Sarah was a puddle, you know, that it was just like game over. You don't have to act.
IndieWire has called Succession the end-all be-all of TV. Emmy eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories. Succession is now streaming on HBO.